Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, teachers and students are back from their holiday break. They're back in school. They're hard at work. Now, there are pressures, maybe too many pressures in some cases, to perform, to measure up, but kids are resilient. And might this be a time of transition in our educational systems, my guest this hour asks. Transition back to a more humane pedagogy, perhaps. Back with us, author and educator Mimi Chenfeld. Mimi is a teacher of more than 50 years. She travels the country and the world, talking with teachers about the joys and challenges of their classroom lives. Among Mimi's books, Teaching by Heart, Teaching in the Key of Life, Creative Experiences for Young Children, and her latest, Celebrating Young Children and Their Teachers. Welcome back, Mimi Chenfeld.
Hi, Fred. Happy to see you.
Happy to see you as well. 614-292-8513. Short comments or questions to openline at WOSU.org. So maybe you say you feel this could be a bit of a transitional time in education, back to policies that are, more kid-friendly or more realistic as far as children are concerned?
Well, you know, Fred, I see good things, and I'm always hopeful. And I do see, you know, I can't say that the landscape is suddenly, you know, dramatically changed, but for sure, just looking at journals, looking at the articles people are writing, looking at the workshops that are being given, there really is a move back to a place just right. You know, turn, it is a gift to be simple. Plus, and I know this is a wonderful quote that I think I've quoted before, but you have come here to find what you already know. So nothing that's been uncovered now or discovered is new. It's old stuff that we should have known and should have remembered, but
for example,
kind of forgot. For instance, positive classrooms. I'm just looking at one of the excellent journals that I just brought in, just to give you an example. The whole Journal of Education Leadership, the positive classroom. Like, ding, how can you teach people if they're stressed and worried and anxious and crying and throwing up? You know, you need a positive.
But what does that mean? That I see this, the cover article, the positive classroom. What does that mean?
It has to do with an educational climate that fosters, you know, a feeling of safety, not just physical safety, but psychological safety, a feeling of sharing, a feeling of openness, a feeling of ability to say, I don't know, to question without fear of ridicule or of intimidation, time to be able to succeed, ways to learn that help you succeed, because there's not just one way to learn. We all have our own learning styles and ways that we can, you know, find good outcomes. It may not be the way, you know, everyone else in the classroom learns, but, you know, the way you learn might be in your own unique pattern. So, you know, a classroom that makes room for diversity so that nobody is left out. So, I mean, inclusion. Mm-hmm. So these kinds of positive energy.
All the good things you've just said. Isn't that kind of a no-brainer that a teacher in a school would do all those things?
This is why I keep going ding, or I keep going duh. You know, I don't think it gets me very far. Yeah. Like, you know, the front page of Educational Leadership, duh. But, you know, here's another one. You know, education in the arts. And the whole thing is about the importance of the arts as ways of learning. So it's, again, the oldest ways of learning in the world are the arts, the first ways humans learned and shared and communicated and transmitted information. And so now it's back to, you know, okay, maybe the arts are more important than we think. So I'm just – maybe it's because I'm old and I've been there, but, you know, the pendulum keeps swinging back and forth and keeps knocking people down when it swings the other way. And I'm just sick that so many of our kids in the last, you know, 20 years have really suffered from a climate that is the opposite of the positive classroom.
I mean, when you think of the arts, songs, and how do we learn? We learn songs. Stories are great for teaching, aren't they?
Stories are the oldest way and the best way. And that will get the attention of children more than when was the war in 1812.
Yeah, question. I remember sitting down in some classes in school, copying questions and answers. When was the war in 1812? Who were the chief figures? I mean, stuff that was absolutely – you forgot it as soon as the test was over because there was no reason for you to care.
Anything.
It didn't mean anything to
you. Right, but a story will mean something.
Oh, yeah.
Look, you know, and the kids are hungry for that. I mean, I'm not into vampires, truly, but some of my best, not that there's anything wrong with them. Some of my
perfectly
best
acceptable
some of my best friends are vampires.
Emotional vampires in some cases, yeah.
But, you know, the kids are loving these Twilight books. And they stayed up all night when the book came out. I mean, they stood on lines. They slept, you know, out on the streets waiting for the bookstores to open to buy the Twilight books.
They're kind of about, I gather, a chaste of vampires.
Right.
I mean,
they're
in love of the chase.
Sort of civilian vampires.
You know? No, they're all military.
You know, we had a very cute story. One of my co-teachers at the Jewish Center Early Childhood Program, I've been there for 38 years, but among other little hats. But one of our teachers, the son of one of our teachers, is a very famous ballet dancer now in Ohio. He's done beautifully, and he dances with the Ohio Ballet Company and so forth. My friend still teaches at the center. And so Damien was a Dracula in their version of Dracula, not the Columbus version, but the Ohio Theater version. So the kids came in with this big, big poster, you know, because I still work with the kids, of course. So they came in, they're like 4 years old, and they came in, Mimi, Carol's son is Dracula. Look at this picture. So they show me this huge poster, and of course he changed a lot since I had him in preschool. It's this gorgeous thing with this cape and this kind of fierce-looking vampire, sexy-looking thing. So he's the whole poster. So I said to the kids, I said, do you know what Damien danced? Do you know what part he had? Yes, he was an umpire. So they kind of thought vampire was an umpire.
Okay.
So you can't really do picture books for the little ones on vampires, but the preteens. The point I was making is the kids are hungry for stories. When they look what they did with Harry Potter. You know, this was just worldwide.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they're hungry for really, I mean, you and I may not like Harry Potter or vampires.
I liked Harry Potter. Yeah.
It was kind of scary. I didn't even read Nancy Drew. I didn't like scary stuff.
Okay. What about you? You say, Mimi, that we got the positive classroom and all the good things you mentioned, but you say that the atmosphere over the last 20 years has been the opposite in
yes.
what way?
Oh, well, of course. Of course, the testing and the pressure on the schools and parents pushing kids and parents worrying that their kids won't succeed and kids not fitting in and charter schools opening and everything, statistics and your measurement and your test scores and your failure and your school getting punished if the test scores go down and teachers getting changed to another school and this. I mean, if you just put all of the things that have been going on, the pressures on teachers and on kids and on families and government legislation that really doesn't know kids. And, you know, we begged the state legislator to cool the state, you know, requirements for the standardized testing widespread across Ohio, and they didn't. But, you know, we said if you were children, the day of the hearings, this is a couple of years ago, I mean, there were people crying, there were people begging. And, you know, the panel of legislators just kind of did their panel of legislators look, you know. I guess they have to practice that look. They can't, like.
What does that look like?
The look is like they don't feel anything, really don't respond. They have to be very cool and you know, and objective. People like throwing themselves on the mercy of the panel, and they were like, next, your time is up, next. So, I mean, it's emotional, you know, when children don't fit and when children flunk out and children who are doing well but they can't test well so that they fail even though they're really good students, but that's not the way they show that they know what they know. So that was – and still going on. I'm not saying that's over, but this is just an example of, you know, the beginning of a change, the beginning of the change back.
You know, when you think of Howard Gardner, his seven, and I think more than that, intelligences that he talks
multiple
about.
Multiple intelligences.
Multiple people that maybe learn better visually, or people who might learn better verbally, or people who are mechanical and visual, you know, and how differently they would learn and how differently also you would have to test them, right?
That's the point. We can't test in all those ways of learning. because some of those are not testable in the way we just want results. You know, this country is like, doesn't realize that education is like a long journey. It's not, you know, a product. But we have all the words of the marketplace. You know, it's a product, you know, and you produce. Mm-hmm. And this is what you show. And you buy it or you sell it. You fail or you succeed. And I think that the point you made is one of the most important points. You know, I had this image. It's a metaphor. You know, sometimes a metaphor hits you. That's a good metaphor. You know, hit by a metaphor. And that's, you know, that we're, you know, when you see a dancer spinning around, spinning, 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 and you say, why don't they fall down? Or a skater just spinning around. How come they don't fall down on their heads? Because they spot. They have one tiny spot that's immovable. As they turn around, they connect with that spot. It's called spotting. And as they do it, as they twirl, every time they, you know, they twirl around, they glance at, they look at that spot. They don't stare at it like, oh, where is that spot? You know,
but they just note it. Yeah.
They know it. And that keeps them balanced. It's really a true physical thing. And I think we're all twirling, we're all whirling, but we lost the spot to focus on. And that's the kids. If we lose that, if we just turn that spot into testing or into assessment or into evaluations, you know, that kind of thing, then we're going to lose it. We're going to lose what, you know, what education's about. So no matter what, and that, and bringing up the multiple intelligences really is about spotting the kids in all the ways they learn and helping them to succeed and learn the way they learn best. Mm-hmm. And that's what the good teachers do.
Sure. Author, educator Mimi Chen Feld is with us. Her latest book, Celebrating Young Children and Their Teachers. We're at 614-292-8513 or email to openline at WOSU.org. I can really understand the impulse behind the comprehensive testing in the sense that, you know, I understand people want to say, well, look, we want to have some kind of way of measuring progress in school, measuring the performance of our teachers, measuring how well our kids are learning, you know, the basics of citizenship and mathematics and words and reading. So you can understand that impulse.
Absolutely. But the challenge is to find a way to measure that so that every kid has a fair, you know, fair shake in the assessment. You know, we just can't, you can't always do that. We can't always do it with one single testing because there were kids, you know, a couple of years ago we were on the program and a gentleman called in. He was very distraught because his daughter, who was a bright student and her papers were good and her classroom work was good and discussion and projects were all good, but she wasn't a tester. So remember, she didn't do well on the test and they wouldn't let her graduate and they didn't even account for her classroom work. So this is going back. That's another thing we're coming back to, quote, portfolio assessment. So in other words, you, Fred, may not be a good tester. But we have a whole portfolio of your other kinds of works. We have your written examples of written work. We have the research project you did. Mm-hmm. We had your classroom discussion, you know, record of how you discuss things and how you learn them in classroom. So you had other kinds of ways to say, is Fred a good student? Where are areas that he needs work in? And not just the test itself. And that is an old thingy.
Yeah.
Ding, duh, but now it's coming back.
I suppose one of the things militating against that kind of portfolio is the idea that that's that kind of testing, if we can call it testing or evidence of learning, is more time-consuming, in that sense more expensive, not as handy, not as convenient.
Not as objective.
And not as objective in the sense you can't compare school to school or
that's
even
right.
student to student. So those are, I guess, some of the objections to doing that. Huh?
But that's why the way we look at education is how we – if we look at education as this, system that's very clear and that you either fail or you pass or it's a good school or a bad school or the grade you – by March 12th, every child is reading on this level, you know, but, oh, my God, March 11th, forget it, you know. If that's the way you look at education, this is the outcome. You know, here's what we put in. Here's our date. Here's how much time we spend. You know, and this is just a funny story. We're just telling someone this story. Another fellow teacher, we were just rolling because you have to have a sense of humor. You can't be in this field or drink a lot.
Yeah,
only kidding. I'm only kidding.
Right.
Anyway, This is going back years and years when I was teaching in the classroom. And this is in New York. And I knew I was getting sick. And I could feel like it was coming down with something. So I took my plan book, which I rarely used in those good old days. And I put, you know, I was teaching fifth grade. And we started immigration. So, I said social studies, immigration. When I think of it, when I was discussing with the kids, that was an hour. You know, it wasn't just like, you know, when was the war in 1812? Okay. So, you know, discuss immigration. And in my mind, I had, you know, where do your parents come from? You know, I didn't write it out. I just figured sure. Discuss. So I had, you know, this kind of little notes in my plan books of the telephone. I'm in bed with fever. The telephone rings like about 10:15 in the morning. Mimi, this is East Greenbush. School, yes. Oh, hi, how are you doing? Your substitute finished your day's plans. What should she do now? I said, how could she finish immigration? When did she finish by 9:30 in the morning? It's over. That's going to last a year.
Sure, yeah.
So it's the way, you know, the way you look at education. If you look at it as a journey full of, you know, different components, different ways of looking at it, you know, the stories of it, the history of things, you know, the questions you could ask, what do we want to know about something? That takes time. It's not a short answer.
That's right.
We don't have patience with that in this country. We're a very instant gratification country. And, I mean, education doesn't fit in with, you know, fast food stuff.
Mm-hmm. We're with author, educator Mimi Chenfeld, and joining us on the telephone. Hi, Mary.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good. Mary.
Hello. I've spent the last 25 years in classrooms, in schools, fixing problems. I've taken high poverty schools where 30% of the children were reading and gotten that up to 70%. What you say sounds so good, but so much of it flies in the face of any kind of research we have, and when applied to high poverty schools, is disastrous. There were no good days. 70% of African American kids in inner city schools who come from high poverty leave high school reading at below a fourth grade level. And that's been the way it's been for the last 20, 25, 30 years. Now, I've seen in schools this accountability. I've seen inner city schools for the first time look at methods, because a reading test is pretty. You read the passage. Can you read the words? Can you answer the questions? It's real basic. The other thing, the multiple intelligences, sounds so good. There has yet to be one school in this country, there are any research study, where they employ multiple intelligences and they get any kind of raised achievement. There's Willingham, who's a wonderful psychologist down in the Carolinas, explains that, yeah, we do all learn differently, but what's more important is how the content's taught. So, for example, reading, we know if we use systematic phonics, we will have 80 to 90% of those kids in those inner city schools reading. And so we talk about the creativity, and what I see in schools, the teachers translate it as they spend hours making maple syrup. They have a Russian folk tale, and they spend a couple days making Russian nesting dolls. And meanwhile, nobody knows where Russia's on a map. It's that Jay Leno thing. Sometimes even the teachers don't know where Russia is on the map, but they've done a cut-and-paste project. And so when I hear this, it's so intuitive, and people out there say, oh, yeah, this is how it should be. Kids want success. I've been involved where I've done nothing but testing, and I've had kids, when we stopped the testing, say, when are you going to ask us more questions? Because they were successful.
Okay, Mary, hang on the line. Let's see what Mimi has to say.
Mary, you know what? I think what you did was fabulous. I absolutely do. And, you know, here's a big problem I have. It's the either or. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's the either or. And so you're either on the side of this or on the side of that. And I said, I don't pick sides. I say whatever works, do. But and I don't say that anything should be systemized. I don't think the multiple intelligence. I've seen the I've seen whole language, which and you go back to that. No, I've seen whole language in workbooks. And I said, wait, what's wrong with this picture? The whole language, you know what I'm saying? The whole language movement was to do away with, you know, systems that were very preset and so forth and give you room to be creative, et cetera. And then they start to – so I don't believe in choosing, having to choose sides. There are kids who absolutely need the phonics. They absolutely need the phonetic awareness. They have to have it. So I don't, and I don't believe that creativity is making the maple syrup. I think it's a way of thinking, a way of thinking.
Yeah. And see, that's what we've got to translate to teachers. But it's not cut and paste.
That's exactly.
It's high level stuff. And that doesn't get translated.
Well, you know, I teach a course every summer called Arts Across the Curriculum at Otterbein, and the first day it's five Thursdays all day. I mean, now it's Monday. This year it'll be Monday all day. We're there all day. But the first thing I said is, I just want you to learn two words: connections. To everything we say is connected to learning everything, and a way of thinking, not a strategy. Not a methodology, but a way. It's like a way of thinking. So what you're saying to me, I mean, I think we're in a complete agreement. I think we're in a complete. It's changing your head. And so you did. Why did the kids love the questions? Why did the kids say more questions, Mary? Because of you, how you presented it.
But it was a standardized test.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what it is. It's how you teach it. If you teach it in a non-stressful way, in a fun way, in a success way, in a way that shows kids, it doesn't matter what it is you're teaching.
So, well, I'm so glad to hear you talk about the success, because that's what matters. And that's where in these inner city schools, I mean, that's why parents go to the charter schools. Some of them, I mean, their opportunity isn't there. And so it's so wonderful when a school, because of the testing, says, We've got to deliver.
Well, that's the pressure we were talking about.
Yeah.
That pressure is just relentless.
I worry when that's gone, because I haven't seen it be relentless. The times I've seen improvement is when the administrators have said, "Oh my gosh, we are a typical school. Only 30% of our kids are reading anywhere near grade level."
Mary, if I understand you correctly, you're saying you kind of like the standardized tests because they hold people to the basics.
It's a good one. A lot of these standardized tests are like the Ohio test. Some of these state tests, they were written so quickly. There's room for improvement in those tests, and you should always look at a couple tests.
Yeah, but Mary,
certain basics that are very – it's much more difficult when you get into high school and you're getting into subject – you know, and what is history? How do you know history? But there's basics. Do you know math? Can you compute? Can you do the – can you read at your grade level? And can you read the text? Do you get the words right?
Yeah,
do you answer the questions? Those are real basic things that when we teach in a way that kids, and my background is special ed, so I've taken kids with 70 IQs and gotten them up to grade level. When we don't do that, we do such a disservice to children. And we shut off their life in the Obama campaign. I was working
Wait, hold
Obama
on just a second. Let you have a response here too.
A few comments back. I had a good thing to say to follow with what you were saying. I mean, I love your passion, and Mary, my whole way of looking at education is, the kids have to succeed. But remember something: the standardized tests have taken over the majority of the way many of the people teach, and they've taken a place much larger than they were originally intended. So when kids come in, the first thing they do, and many of the kids, is here's your practice, you know, we start practicing for.
And that's horrible.
And right.
I believe that if you take
that's
more
right.
tests, you're going to pass the test rather than if you teach well.
Well.
But that's not the test fault.
Right.
That's the
it's also the effects of the tests. If you don't do well, if your school doesn't do well, then there come the charter schools, and there come the vouchers, and there come the punishments. And I mean, it's a whole ball of wax that's going on there. But I absolutely agree with you about the success and the children, and the fact that you teach it in the way you taught it is why it worked more than anything.
And Mary, I'm sorry to interrupt. We have to go. We have to break here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, well, you can tell I'm impassioned
Fine. That's great. That's always tremendous. And thank you so much for taking the time to call us today.
Well, thank you for answering my questions.
Sure thing. Author, educator Mimi Chenfeld is with us. We're going to take a break here for a couple of announcements. Callers, hang on the line. Back in just a couple of minutes here at WOSU 820 NPR News.
Next time on Day to Day.
Some parents in Hollywood thought they hired their own Mary Poppins.
Every child loved her.
She's a godsend.
They're almost too good to be true.
Now they charge their practically perfect nanny did more conning than caretaking.
She didn't use money or false identity. She used our kids.
A once-loved nanny becomes a national villain.
I don't know why they bother me. The kids is okay.
Next time on Day to Day.
Day to Day begins in 30 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Corporate partners help provide support for WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, appreciative audience every day. Be associated with a trusted local and national source for accurate news coverage. For more information, contact Christine Shodich at 247-4469. And thanks for supporting WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the Columbus Foundation, proud to present Power of Philanthropy, a powerful new giving tool available to everyone. More information is available on the web at columbusfoundation.org.
We'll get back to Open Line in just a moment. 21 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today and a high of 28. Tonight, partly cloudy and a low of 17. For Friday, partly sunny with clouds moving in the afternoon and a high of 35. You're listening to WOSU 820, NPR News. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820, NPR News. I'm Fred Andrew, the author, educator. Mimi Chenfeld is with us. Her latest book, Celebrating Young Children and Their Teachers, 614-292-8513. Mimi, we were talking during the break, and you mentioned that of course, our previous caller, Mary, was so great, you mentioned that teaching is a gift, and sometimes a really great teacher doesn't even know how good they are.
I was thinking of that with Mary.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the kids were excited about questions and ask us more and are we going to do more. It's the way she taught it. I mean, we can have four classrooms, one next door to each other, all have the exact same curriculum, all have exactly the same assignments, everything. And class one, you know, is just real, you know, strict, rigid, you know, questions, answers with the same material. And down the line to the fourth one, which is like talk, discuss, make it fun, turn it into something, you know, another layer of excitement, you know, add surprise, add laughter, add humor, and make it an enjoyable experience. The exact same material, so the testing could be like the material.
Mm-hmm.
And which room would you want your kid to go to? And then you say, how come? Because this teacher is the kind of a person she is or he is.
Sure.
So I think Mary doesn't even realize the kind of a teacher she is because it's an art. It's a gift. Sometimes you can't teach it. You know, I had one experience, and I'm afraid you told me something that I wanted you to share.
Okay.
But, you know, I have this article that was published a few years ago called Metaphors of Hope. And I talked about five different teachers and just how they – you know, with signs of hope and life and affirmation in sometimes a grim landscape. And so one of the teachers was Kathy Arment, who teaches in Whitehall. And she had called me one day, and she called me from the classroom and said, ma'am, you can't believe this is so great. She said she taught first grade in Whitehall with a lot of diverse background kids and some pretty good poverty kids. And she was reading a story to them, and she looked up from reading the story, and they were all just sitting in little clusters with their arms around each other, the whole class, right, listening to her story. And she was so hit, she was so touched that all these little guys with different languages and colors and races and religions, they just, you know, just hit her. So she called me with kind of teary and went, "Ma'am, you cannot believe." I just looked up and saw. So I said, so I called her later. I said, how did that happen? That there was this lovingness and this warmth. She says, "I don't know." I wanted her in the article because everyone else in the article was like, "Well, I used this strategy and I adopted this program that I read about making a positive climate." And I wanted Kathy because I wanted her to go, "I don't know." Because and you know why? Because she's a loving, warm person who will not let anyone be hurt.
Yeah.
And this is the way she is, and that's the climate of her classroom.
It's almost unconscious.
I wanted
that's there. Who she is.
And so, yes, and Mary, in a way, was kind of reminding me that she just, you know, you take 10 teachers doing the same kind of thing she was doing, and maybe some of the kids don't want to come to school, and some of them are scared, and some of them think they're going to be wrong, and some of them have stomach aches. But she had a group of kids who was excited and learned and celebrated their success and wanted more questions. So I went to that point.
Absolutely. I remember substituting in a Central City school back east in an eastern city. The kids were poor. It was the fifth grade. And I walked in, and I sat down in front of them, and they all looked very alert. And I began – I forget what the subject matter was, but I began asking questions. Every hand would go up after every question I asked, and we'd talk and discuss, and they were always so eager. And I knew right away this must have been a phenomenal teacher that I'm substituting for. I had a week with that class, and it was marvelous. And I'd never met the teacher, but she had to be something. She really did. You could tell.
You could see from the way the kid – we were just in School of Rock – Jack Black, which is a hilarious movie. I just love the movie. Sorry to admit it, but it's a great movie.
It is.
And how the kids were very, you know, structured and stiff at the beginning when he came in, and this is the way we do things, and this is how it is. And, of course, he's a bit extreme in the movie. But you could just see that was the kind of classroom when he walked in. The little girl who knew how to do everything and corrected him. This isn't the way we do things. And so that was the way the class was taught.
Yeah.
So you can see, even without a teacher there, the kind of class, yeah.
Our caller here is Harold. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Fred. Interesting topic.
Hi, Harold.
Hi, Mamie. I've wondered for a long time about something concerning the structure or the industry of education. On one end, you have the frontline providers, the teachers and administrators within the school. And then you have the consumer, the students, and that makes up the consumer side. And then on the opposite end of that, you have the business side of it. You have the book industry, which seems to be consolidated in within a certain segment, and pretty well controlled or kind of a follow the leader sort of thing. And you have the motives behind what your goals are in teaching in education. And you kind of look at some of the foreign countries that are getting better results. And I wonder about how their business end operates vis-a-vis how we operate in this country. Because it seems to me that there's been a political agenda towards cheap labor, towards downsizing expectations in the economy and a lot of other elements that entered into the educational process that ended up leading us to some of the results that we're getting today, some of the things we see. And I wondered if you'd comment on that.
Sure.
And go in that direction a little bit.
Yeah, Mimi.
Sure. Harold, you know, it's so interesting listening to you because we were just saying that because of the kind of culture we have, the society that is, you know, really predominantly, you know, business dominated, the media using, you know, the language of the marketplace to apply to education. If you heard yourself, you were really reflecting that, looking at it that way. I don't mean that's the way you look at it, but that's a way that I think the whole culture looks at education. I don't think we have the time or the mind frames in our country to look at it in a different way. I think that that's one of the problems. Because children, you know, it's not a product, and you know, consume. You know, people say, you know, the parents are the consumers, and if they're not happy, then they won't buy. You know, is that kind of thing? Does that make sense to you?
Well, it makes perfect sense.
You know, right, that they want a product, and if they're not going to get it here, they're going to go elsewhere, you know, take their money elsewhere and find the product that they're looking for. But, you know, maybe I'm in my little la-la land of thinking, but to me, you know, that's a hard way to look at education. It really is a hard way because sometimes you don't get results for months. Sometimes it takes a person a long time to learn something. And so it doesn't fit into that framework. And so people get impatient and they go, this product isn't good. And then maybe, you know, the following year a child will say, you know, I really just got it, you know. I just got the whole immigration story, Mom. You know, we did it last year, but now that I read this book, this year it fell into place. We don't have that time. But education takes time, and it's on another level. It's you know, we should have. I think we still need to go back to the magical level of imagination and curiosity and the whole idea of the mind and the ability to learn languages. And you remember that our culture is very diverse. We educate more people from different backgrounds and races and religions and economic levels than I think probably most any culture in any society in the world. The ones that succeed so much are the ones that have like one kind of people, you know. They don't really have, like, English as a second language and 20,000 Somali people coming to Columbus. So we try to teach all the children, and we try to teach them in a way that we hope will succeed. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's kind of my response so far. Of course, I'm a blah-blah person, so I probably have more response.
Well, I noticed that, you know, a few years ago there were political efforts to eliminate the Department of Education nationally, and there were all kinds of things that were going on in this country as part of a political frustration that manifested itself in a lot of the stuff that we see today with testing and a lot of the other stuff. And it just seems to me that in some foreign countries, the kids know why they should get an education. They are at a point where they understand the importance of education, and they're motivated because they see the necessity or they understand what it will do for them. In this country, I'm not sure children really feel that need. They go home, they watch education, which is they watch television, which is a one-way kind of thing. Finally, we have computers that kids can interact with, and now it's two-way. So, I think that improved. But for 50 years of watching television in this country, all they had to do was just sit there and do nothing.
Mm-hmm. Harold, you know, let me say one more thing. This is such an important point you made. And the role models in our country for children have nothing to do with education. And this is my wish, and I'm going to write to our new president about it. He has the power and the inspirational effect of bringing together these music people, these sports people who the kids worship, you know, these teeny bopper people, and saying, look, we need you to really be out there giving the message on the importance of education. And I think he should do a summit because it's a waste for all the athletes and all the music. What's her name? Montana, you know, whatever her name is. You know, Hannah Montana. I mean, these kids are worshipped. They're worshipped by they're influencing them tremendously, and they could influence them in a better way to say, let's talk about education and why we need it. And remember, we also have a poverty class of children who are, like many of them, from different homes and different, you know, settings that do not get a motivation to go out and learn. They don't see many people in their family or their community making this important. So we have a lot of levels to work on in that area.
Great. Harold, thanks for your call. Got to move on. Author, educator Mimi Chenfeld is with us. More than 50 years a teacher. She travels around the country and around the world talking with teachers about the joys and challenges of their classroom lives. And my guest's latest book, Celebrating Young Children and Their Teachers, 614-292-8513. Email comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. And next on the air is Tina. Hi, Tina. You're with us.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Tina.
Hi. I'm calling in because I think that teaching is a noble profession still, no matter what conditions are. And I think very highly of teachers. I know that these days their jobs are really fragmented. I imagine there's just so many social problems that are being brought into the schools. My comment and question is, you were speaking about in the classroom, the teachers, something about creating psychological safety. And I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit more about that, how that's conducted. And it sounds like therapy to me, and I think that that's kind of inappropriate in a school setting, personally. Therapy is very specific.
Hang on, Tina. I think, Mimi, I didn't get the impression you were talking about therapy. Yeah.
No, Tina, absolutely not, and I wouldn't even go into that topic. My point about psychological safety is, and going back to Mary and the way she taught, or just Kathy Arment, is that in this classroom, we are safe to ask questions. In this classroom, we will not tolerate anyone being put down. In this classroom, there will be no bullying, and we'll do everything we can to break up cliques, because even in preschool, the kids are starting little cliques, which we won't go into now. But bullying is a very big issue. So, if there is ridicule, or if there is put downs, if there are put downs in a classroom, or kids are afraid to ask because they'll be made fun of, then there's no teaching. You can't teach.
And how do they conduct that? I mean, how do they do that? Because I'm sure that the kids do it.
Yes, but day one,
that's a lot of time.
If you see the schools where it works, you know, this is very interesting. I think I mentioned this story once. In Indianola Elementary, now it's up to eighth grade. It's the arts magnet school in Columbus. They have a wonderful, wonderful climate in the school. The climate is that we're all like family, and we all know each other. We care about each other. I mean, this is just from top to bottom. This is the way it is. So they had a couple of years ago, a little boy came from another school, and he was kind of, antagonistic, and he was, kind of rough, and, kind of maybe started name calling. And the other kids just kind of said, "What's going on? We don't do that here." So, it can't be, it's not a technique. It's from head to toe, from principal to custodian. This is the way it is. If we see kids acting out, if we see kids ridiculing, we just stop everything. We just stop and we go, "Well, we're not going on until we talk about this." And then they realize after a while that the only way they can learn in a healthy and good way is to have a safe environment where they can feel that no one will put them down, that they're connected to the other kids, that there's a feeling of cohesion. And that happens. It's not a technique. You'll find that also, but it's not therapy. We're not talking about therapy. Did that make sense?
I understand what you're saying. I think that it's interesting. I think that it's probably helpful for the teaching environment. It doesn't mirror the world. Unfortunately, the adult world is, no one's going to protect you from any of these things.
Yeah,
so I find that interesting. It's kind of like, that's not the experience in society. I mean, you're going to be a person that's subjected to all kinds of things. I understand why.
Why should we double it?
I don't think anyone should double anything. I just can see how they would come out of school and kind of expect the same thing to be happening. It must be really a shock for these people.
Well,
regular society.
We're idealizing the way I described it. But let me just say this: if you had a child and that child went into school every day and was afraid to open his or her mouth and had no friends to sit with, and kids clicked off and didn't want to hold his hand or be near him, and he was afraid to say he didn't understand anything, and he was afraid he'd get put down by the teacher or by the other kids, do you think that would be a good environment for him to learn?
No, in fact, most of my middle school years were spent like that, being completely – I was a female in the school system, and you're basically ignored. Personally, that was my experience. So I can relate to a little bit of that. I was fearful to open my mouth as well. I mean, I think I'm stronger for it, but I'm not really judging anything. I just wanted you to talk about it, and I appreciate you taking my call.
Hey, Tina, thanks so much for your call.
Thanks, Tina.
I went to a high school where, in fact, ridicule was encouraged by teachers, where teachers themselves ridiculed, where they encouraged other students to ridicule, and where bullying was very common and nothing was done about it. And let me tell you, I do not go to the reunions of that high school.
Well, there's the case closed.
Yeah, it was awful.
But you know, it's interesting. Tina brought up the fact that you're not training them for the real world. But I think of many, that we need the cities of refuge. I think of my feeling about what school should be. Okay, people go, ma'am, you're always in your little la la land. But my feeling, and I know it's possible, and I know teachers all over the country who create this, is a city of refuge.
Yeah.
And I say to teachers, you can hardly do anything about home life. You can hardly do anything about community or jobs for parents or divorced or any of those things. The only thing you really can do is something about your space and your time with the kids. And the kids need to know that there are places in this world that is safe, that's warm, that's welcoming, that's encouraging, and that people are connected and share and have a wonderful year together. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that. They know the rest of the world. There's no kid who's separate from the knowledge that the world is a rough place. And I think they need the experiences of knowing that there are other ways.
Absolutely. We have an email here from a listener who said, I completed thesis work on teachers encouraging or discouraging single parents' roles in primary education. And I've done weekly after-school workshops in urban St. Louis, says our emailer. Our focus was to include aspects of all learning styles in every workshop. Though planning each workshop was challenging, I really did see different students' strengths shine when we varied projects and tasks. It allowed each to feel successful. Mimi says, our listener, thank you so much for sharing your work with the listeners. After research and teaching, I'm in total agreement with your work.
Well, great. We need all the help we can get in this in this adventure.
And our next caller here with author educator Mimi Chenfeld is Bill. Hello, Bill.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Good.
Hi, Bill.
I just wanted to share an observation. I'm actually an alumnus of the Indianola Alternative Elementary School. I graduated from there, 1982?
Oh, I was probably there in and out and saw you, hon.
Quite possibly. I can't say that I remember, but that's just my memory issue. I'd like to observe that school at Indianola, it was about family. It was about having groups of individuals that acted like a family. And what really what I took away from it was not that the world wasn't a hard place, but that there were good places in the world. And that's I had a great home life. Don't misunderstand that, but. The elementary school experience was a very good experience for me. And, I went through the entire alternative school program, Fred Franklin and the CAS. And that educational process prepared me well. I don't think it's Pollyanna-esque. I don't think that it's overly shielding to make sure that kids have a good, safe, loving, respectful environment in which to learn. I think those are really important values that have been deeply instilled in me in large part by the successful educational processes in these excellent schools.
Bill, you could not have said it better. That was beautiful, and I'm so glad you called.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks so much for your contribution today. We have 5 minutes or so, 614-292-8513 with author educator Mimi Chenfeld. Having gone to schools where there were these emotionally safe environments myself and where there were not, the high school that I mentioned, I can tell you it makes all the difference in the world.
It's life and death.
Yeah.
I call it teaching in the key of life or teaching in the key of death.
Yeah.
And it's that simple.
And what I could never understand was, as I said, the high school that I went to, certainly not all the teachers were in on this ridiculing, but a sufficient number of them were. Everybody knew the bullying was going on. And for teachers to encourage the ridicule.
I'm literally physically sick to
hear
this.
Or to tolerate the bullying is amazing to me. Those weren't teachers. I don't know what to call them. They had some other kind of vocation, but it surely was not for teaching.
that, you know, these are the people I wish would just, you know, when I do work with teachers, I say, look, I'm going to just give you the bottom line. If you do not love and respect the kids, and if it doesn't feel like a calling, a sacred calling, please do something else. Mm-hmm. For your sake and their sake.
Surely.
Do something. It's okay. We encourage you to seek other career options. Do not stay with the kids if you do not love and care about them. When I say to teachers, if one kid is bullied or put down in a room and the others and a teacher does nothing, that every child in that room is bullied and knows that it's okay and they're not safe. So I think this is a number one, and I think it was Tina, I forgot which one of our friends who called, said, you know, this takes too much time. It doesn't take time to immediately respond and stop everything. You know, it's interesting, the introduction, there are more calls.
Suddenly we have 3 minutes to go and six callers on the line. We're not going to get to everybody.
I'll tell the story next time.
Okay, we'll get to a couple of callers anyway. So callers, be concise if you can, and we'll try to get to a few. Julie, hi, you're on the line.
Hi, Julie.
Hi, thank you. My 3 and 4-year-old grandchildren are in a very loving, supportive, a lot of family involvement, but they are not in preschool, and they do not use computers. My daughter feels strongly as they shouldn't be. My question to you, Mimi, is do you think they should be using computers, a computer at their age, the home computer or my computer, and if they are using it, what should we be doing on there? Thank you.
Oh, boy, okay. You're asking the right person. I am in a cave, Julie, as far as I think the kids will soon enough learn their computers. But the kids who start with computers and sit there all day are having problems learning how to play, because they're saying, you know, we need to have these play workshops to teach children how to play with each other and play by themselves. So I don't think there's any rush for little ones to have computers. I'm at the JC, and we have kids from birth to 5 years old, mm-hmm. and I don't think we have a computer in any classroom.
Okay.
And they're wonderful. The kids are doing wonderfully.
Julie, thanks for your question. We have time for a question or comment from Deborah. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Mimi. First of all, I adore you, and you know that. So hello, hello, and I love you. But secondly, I really do think that we are teaching children to create our future. And so teaching children to be fearful and keep their mouths closed is not serving their or our best interest, because they're creating the next world. And I would much prefer a world that is loving and supportive and where people are truthful about where they are and how they feel and how they want to treat others, than the world that's been created by people who have been put in this very fearful, judging, isolating place that we call school so often.
Deborah, thanks so much.
Well said, Deborah.
Thanks so much for your comments. And we have time for a quick Laura, about 30 seconds. Hi.
Hi, Laura.
Hi. The prior caller just pretty much said what I wanted to say, too, which is, when we say, oh, well, we're not preparing kids for the real world, my response is, you know what? Who is the real world? That's us. That's you and me and all of us out there. And how we treat each other, that's the message that we give to kids. So anyway, thank
all right.
you.
Those are the real lessons.
Thank you so much. Okay. Well, we're out of time. I guess that people really are responding to this idea of how we set up an environment in a school. Is it a safe emotional environment for learning? And all kinds of comments. So, author, educator Mimi Chenfeld, more than 50 years a teacher. Her latest book, Celebrating Young Children and Their Teachers. Mimi, thanks so much.
Thank you, Fred, and everyone who called.
And the news is next on WOSU 820. Listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Thrifty Airport Valet Parking, a valet service for business and leisure travelers that takes you in your car to curbside check-in at Port Columbus, 614-237-5800 or thriftycolumbus.com.